Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Education means emancipation. It means light and liberty. It means the uplifting of the soul of man into the glorious light of truth. Well, American statesman, abolitionist, and intellectual Frederick Douglass said that in 1894. He called what happened in schools, quote, a display of the best elements of advanced civilization and good citizenship. We should note, he was talking about the hope in newly opened schools for formerly enslaved African Americans in the 19th century. But overall, that at the heart is the mission of American public education, citizenship, not politics. But nevertheless, politics is in the classroom. It's embedded in history textbooks to the point where the same textbook, two different versions in two different states, seem to present two different realities when it comes to understanding American history. That's according to a major investigation by the New York Times. So what impact does that have on students who read these textbooks about the stories they learn and the values they glean from our shared history? This hour on Point, Political Divides in American Textbooks. And you can join us. Are you a history or social studies teacher or high school student right now? What does the textbook that you use have to say about, say, the Bill of Rights or the Civil Rights Movement or about immigration in America, about the Second Amendment? Is it telling the whole story? And is that textbook telling a fair story? Join us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Dana Goldstein joins us today from New York. She's a national correspondent for the New York Times focused on education. She's also author of The Teacher Wars, a history of America's most embattled profession. And Dana spent 5 months reading 4,800 pages of American history textbook books for her investigation. I say that because I just, my hat's off to you, Dana. Let me just wrap up your intro here for the investigation that appears in the New York Times. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. So, Dana, welcome back to you.
Thanks so much, Magna. I'm really pleased to be here.
I mean, honestly, hearing that you read almost 5,000 pages of U.S. history gave me flashbacks from cramming for my AP U.S. history test in high school. But first of all, tell us, what was the reason that you wanted to even engage in this investigation in the first place? To just ask the question that do we have differing histories in different textbooks in America?
Well, I knew from previous reporting by myself and a lot of other wonderful reporters across the country that there were these really vociferous, sometimes nasty political debates in state legislatures and boards of education in many, many states about what should be taught in history class or civics class and what the state standards for those subjects should be. And I had previously covered a battle in Michigan over whether it is accurate to describe the United States as a democracy. Believe it or not. And after I finished that piece about Michigan, I realized, you know, after these standards are produced by state policymakers, they land in the halls of textbook publishers. And the textbook publishers create their textbooks to meet these standards. And those are the books that are handed to teachers and then handed to students. So I wanted to follow this process. And what we really wanted to do at the Times and what we were able to do thanks to our fantastic graphics and design team is to show folks these pages side by side, because it's one thing to know that, you know, California teaches history in a different way than Texas, but it's another to actually see these stunning examples.
Right. So you focused on California and Texas, the two biggest states in the nation. But why them in particular?
They're not just the two largest states, and they're not just sort of the cliche red state and the cliche blue state, but they also influence what kids learn in other states because they're the two largest markets for the textbook industry. If you create a history textbook and it is not adopted by those two states, you may not have a product that's successful on the market. So students in many other states may end up seeing some of this material that we've laid out here in this analysis that we've done.
Okay, so let's get to some of the examples, because they really are quite eye-opening. These are high school American history textbooks. Let's talk about immigration, because they're major themes, both in the textbooks and in American life, especially right now. Mm. So in a section on immigration, what's in the California version of this history textbook?
Sure. So this is an 11th grade book, and the students read about recent debates on immigration since about the 80s till today. And then there's some excerpts, pieces of writing for them to dive into at the end of the chapter. And especially the way the curriculum is changing, these kinds of excerpts that are sort of primary sources are very popular with teachers right now. There's an emphasis on having students read more primary sources. So the California book has a long excerpt from the novel How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent, and it is a novel about tensions in a Dominican American family. So it's really asking the student to relate to the experience of being a child who immigrates to the United States and sort of have compassion for that, what that experience would be like. The chunkiest, biggest excerpt in the Texas version of the book is from a Border Patrol agent. The Border Patrol agent speaks about his concerns about drug trafficking at the southern border of the United States, and then he then says that there will be social upheaval, quote unquote, if we open up the borders.
Okay. So the narrative from the Border Patrol agent that appears in the Texas version of the textbook, that does not appear at all in the California one?
That's right. And there's other information on immigration that is the same in both books, but this sort of very large narrative from the Border Patrol agent is completely absent from the California book.
And the Alvarez excerpt about the Dominican-American family, does that appear in the Texas one?
No. There are some voices of immigrants in just a couple sentences each that are quoted in the Texas book, but not that sort of significant literary excerpt.
Okay. And this is a McGraw-Hill textbook, right? So what did McGraw-Hill say about why these two pages were so different in the two states?
Well, they pointed back to the standards that are promulgated by policymakers. So in California, where Democrats control this process, they have really emphasized the diversity of immigrants to the United States and really having students understand the positive contributions of many different immigrant groups to the United States. Whereas in Texas, at the time this book was produced, which was 5 or 6 years ago, the standards specifically required students to analyze both legal and illegal immigration. So from the viewpoint of the publisher, they are simply fulfilling what they've been asked to do by the two states.
Okay, so what about, let's go back in time, Civil War history. What differences do we see there?
So when I started the project, I thought there might be big differences on the Civil War itself, and that was not true. Okay. There were not big differences on the Civil War. But once you get to Reconstruction, there were some big differences, and readers are really responding to the ways in which African-American history are reflected differently in the two books. So take lynchings, for example. Both the California and Texas version of one book will say that breaches of racial etiquettes led to lynchings. So that might be the type of example of, you know, a young black boy whistling at a white woman, for example. However, the California book then goes on to talk about specific lynchings, like the ones in Wilmington, North Carolina, that were specifically about, you know, beating back African-American political and economic power, burning black businesses. So it's a much richer history of why the sort of white riots and white violence took place.
Interesting. Okay. And then we have, I'm kind of jumping around in time here, flipping through the various chapters, metaphorically speaking here. There's a really interesting comparison that you have in terms of white flight in the 1950s.
Yes.
Into suburban America. And I just want to read the section from the California version of the textbook, page 505 of this textbook. It says, reasons for suburban growth varied. Some people wished to escape the crime and congestion of the city. Movement of some white Americans from cities to suburbs was driven by a desire to get away from more culturally diverse neighborhoods. Others believed suburbs offered better and more affordable living. So that's in the California version. What part of that is missing from the Texas version?
So the idea that white flight from the city was driven by a desire to get away from diversity. Now, they use the term cultural diversity. It might be more accurate to say racial diversity or specifically from African Americans. That is not in the Texas book. And I'd also call attention to what comes right after the passage that you read, which is the California book goes on to detail the types of housing discrimination that were predominant during the 1950s against Black Americans, such as redlining and restrictive deeds. That is not in the Texas textbook at all. So in Texas, you have a more sort of optimistic take on the suburban dream and this prosperous time of the baby boom and what it was like in post-war America. But in California, you have a sort of more in-depth description of the fact that it was limited who could benefit from this prosperity.
Wow. Okay, so Dana, you read almost 5,000 pages of textbooks. What did you come away with? I mean, what impressions did you come away with about the stories, the history that students in various states are learning? Are they learning very, very different histories?
Well, I think on the whole, the sweeping narrative is similar. You know, people have asked me, well, is there anything positive about immigration in Texas textbooks? And there absolutely is. There absolutely is the message that the United States has served as a refuge for people escaping persecution from around the world. There absolutely is, you know, that Ellis Island history that we all grew up with and know so well in this country. So, you know, while most of the material in the books is the same, I think it is very telling to look at the differences because although students don't retain or memorize everything they read in these books, and many teachers don't even require their kids to read every page of the book, in fact, no teacher would probably require that. It would be impossible. I think that, you know, this provides the outline that teachers then use to create their lessons. So it's very different on some very important subjects.
And it goes without saying, or maybe I should just underscore it, it's also what these various states are saying they think it's important for students to learn. It's the version
right.
of the story they want students to. Yeah.
Yes. This tells you a lot about what policymakers and elected politicians in these two states believe is important about American history. And I would argue it tells you in some ways more about politics than about education.
Well, we have to take a quick break. We'll come right back. We're talking this hour about A Tale of Two Textbooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about A Tale of Two Textbooks. Dana Goldstein joins us. She's a national correspondent for The New York Times and author of the book The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. But we're talking to Dana today because she spent quite a bit of time, many months, reading 4,800 pages of history textbooks that are used in classrooms in Texas and California. The same textbooks, two different versions, to find out how they differ across the country and how partisan politics is shaping what's in those textbooks. So we want to hear from you if you're a teacher or a student right now. What are the stories that are being told to you in the history textbooks that you use? Do you think it's telling the whole story? And do you see a direct line between partisan politics and what's being taught in the classroom? Now, Dana, I was wondering if you could just walk us through for a second in the intricacies on how these textbooks get created. We're going to talk to an author of these textbooks in just a second. Mm-hmm. But once the person writes it, then, as you mentioned earlier, states review it, right? So what happens then?
Yeah, so usually academic historians like Professor Broussard, who's joining us later, will come together in committees to write the books. And they're paying attention to what states want students to learn in that process. But once there's sort of a national version of these texts, the customization process for some of the larger states will begin. Now, in California, the State Board of Education is appointed by the governor, and they will then appoint other folks, and most of them are teachers or college professors, to review drafts of textbooks. And you'll see this committee will read the book very carefully and will come up with specific recommendations that they will then send to the publishers. And in Texas, there's a similar process. The State Board of Education, which in Texas is elected popularly by the public, they appoint folks to these committees. Now, in Texas, there's a greater diversity of people on those committees. It could be a parent. It could be a minister. It could be a business leader in the community. They will go through the drafts of the books, and they will then also submit requests for changes to the publishing companies. Now, if the companies want the districts to go ahead and buy their books, they go ahead and make many of these changes, if not most of them.
Okay. So I want to play a moment from a 2012 documentary called The Revisionaries. And this documentary follows former Texas State Board of Education member Don McElroy and his efforts to have an impact on textbook content in accordance to his political views. So in this clip from the film, you'll hear him speaking at a Tea Party convention in Bastrop, Texas.
Their godless left-wing culture has taken over the mainstream media. They have taken over our universities. Thousands of professors have converted our universities into left-wing seminaries. And for the last 2 years, with the help of their young converts, these so-called experts have taken over our national government. Well, I disagree with those experts. Somebody's got to stand up to experts.
That's Don McElroy in the 2012 documentary, The Revisionaries. His term on the State Board of Education ended in 2011. So it seems as if the members of these boards have a lot of influence, a lot of power over the very materials that students will be using.
Yes, they do. For example, one debate that I report on in the piece, and it's well known among some in Texas, but you know, to bring it to our national audience, I'll just briefly describe it. The Republicans and Democrats on the Texas State Board of Education disagreed about whether cultural movements like hip hop or the Harlem Renaissance or country music should be discussed in textbooks. And some of the conservatives felt like hip hop should not be discussed, for example. And they go back and forth and they debate which cultural movements should be covered. And eventually they come up with their list, which does not include hip hop in the end, but does include the Harlem Renaissance. And they say, you know, kids can learn about these avant-garde cultural movements, or they were avant-garde at the time, but they must hear both the positive and negative impacts of these movements. So as a result, two of the textbook publishers that I reviewed include sort of critical or negative language about non-white cultural movements like the Harlem Renaissance or the Chicano mural movement of the 60s and 70s only in their Texas books. And in some Florida books I've seen as well. But the California books don't include this language. So one that we showed in our piece is that, you know, there's questions raised about whether Harlem Renaissance literature like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston is, quote, quality literature. And that people found that quite shocking that that would be there in those Texas books.
You know, there's sort of lens upon lens upon lens of politics that people have been viewing your story through here, Dana. I mean, we have a comment coming in on our Facebook page from M. Stephen, who says, so the Texas Commission asked for historical events to be given realistic context, and the California Commission asked for language to be rewritten to satisfy politically correct considerations. M. Stevens says it's become obvious that progressive liberalism's interpretations of history is revisionist. So there are conservative critiques of what's in the California textbooks.
Absolutely. And I just want to be clear that when I say that ideology is influencing the curriculum, I do mean from both the right and left. I mean, here's an example. In California, a law passed in 2011 that required students to learn about the contributions of LGBTQ Americans. And so in response to that, publishers produced thousands of new words of history on LGBTQ history. And that will not be in Texas books, but it will be emphasized in California. And whether or not you believe that 11th graders should learn about early sex reassignment surgeries in the 1950s or non-binary gender identities within Native American tribal communities, whether or not you agree with that is definitely going to depend on your orientation toward LGBTQ issues, and people will disagree.
Let's go to a quick call. Let's go to Renee, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Renee, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. So this topic came up with my husband and I, and these disparities in history books have actually gone back a couple of decades. When he was in history class back in the late 80s, when he was living in New Jersey, the same textbook, the same paragraph, everything about the Civil War, where it painted Southern soldiers as colonels, as like war criminals, his family then moved to South Carolina. Same textbook, same information, one paragraph, same exact paragraph, then painted these same officers as war heroes. And this is a disparity that's been going on for a very long time.
Mm. Renee, thanks. Yes. Yeah, thank you so much for your call. Dana, go ahead.
That's true. I mean, it's been going on for longer than decades, but historians have shown it's been going on for centuries, in fact. I mean, there is no neutral history, and I don't think that many people believe there can ever be a totally consensus history of the United States. I will say that as part of my research, I did read old books going back to about the 1890s to now, and I have noticed that on the whole, the textbooks are much more inclusive than they were in the past. On the whole, they are much much fairer about the Civil War and about racism. And on the whole, they have improved, I would say, over time.
Mm. Well, I mean, it is true that the stories we tell about our past are a product of the times we're living in now.
Yes.
So, well, Dana, stand by here for just a second. Let's turn now to Albert Broussard. He's joining us from College Station, Texas. He's a professor of history at Texas A&M University and co-author of a number of textbooks for high school students that have been adapted in various states, including Texas and California. Professor Broussard, welcome to On Point.
Hello, and I'm delighted to be here.
And thank you so much for your patience, because Dana had a lot of original reporting to walk us through there. So I appreciate you waiting. So first of all, what do you make of how the original material that you have written for one of these textbooks, what do you make of the changes that they undergo in these various states?
Well, let me get back to a couple of comments. Renee's comment that this has been going on for many, many decades is absolutely correct. The other comment, I believe it's one that Dana made, is that the local school districts really have a tremendous amount of power, not just the state boards of education, but it really boils down to the school districts, and they have really the option of selecting or not selecting or multiple textbooks. And that's based on a number of considerations, but as Dana's excellent reporting has indicated, it really boils down to the politics of that particular, not just state, I would say, but even locality, because you can have school districts within a conservative state like Texas or Louisiana. Let's take Austin, Texas, for example. I suspect what's being taught at that kind of school district or that school district would be radically different than in a more conservative city in the state of Texas. So we get a list of state standards when we are either writing from scratch, which we do every blue moon, or revising, which is much more common with textbooks. And every state has their list, and some, as Dana knows, are far more extensive than others. And we really do have to follow those, but we don't get the final word on what goes into the textbooks. Then that goes to a list of consultants and other educators. And so, yes, it does really have to conform conform to what the states deem to be important for their own communities.
Okay, so let me rephrase then. In terms of the California or Texas versions of these books we're talking about, how far do they deviate from what you think should be the history presented in the books?
Well, they can deviate quite a bit, and it's often a crime of omission or really sanitizing, as Dana has pointed out, the language. In some cases, things are simply left out, right? Some of these topics are quite politically charged. We call them difficult dialogues at Texas A&M. It's what I've been doing for the last 40-plus years, teaching U.S. race relations, African-American history. But when you get to the middle school level, when students are 12 and 13, or the high school level, where they're 15, 16, 17, often parents will interject their own opinions. And so they can change quite a bit, quite frankly.
So, Professor, you are a professor of history. I guess what I really want to know is, to state the obvious, but what I really want to know is, what impact are these different versions of these textbooks having on young people's understanding of the history of this nation when they arrive in your classroom at Texas A&M? Are they carrying them with them, sort of accurate? Every word I can think of is sort of value loaded here, but an accurate understanding of American history.
Yes, and no, both. And so let me give you kind of the quick version, and that is we often, when we get students in our college classrooms as freshmen or second year, and every student in the state of Texas must pass or test out of six units of American history, we often have to reteach students much of this material because they either did not learn it at the high school level, unless they went to a very progressive high school, or they learned, as I said, a fairly sanitized or abbreviated version of this material. And often the students will feel cheated. And one of the most common comments that I get is, why didn't I learn this in high school? Why didn't I learn this in middle school, right? And so if you talk about, for example, the Founding Fathers, the Declaration of Independence, you know, it's probably not going to be mentioned in a middle school textbook that a third of the signers of the Declaration of Independence on slaves. It's not going to be mentioned that Thomas Jefferson, who wrote one of the most radical documents on human liberty, not only owned hundreds of slaves, but fathered children by one of his slaves. You know, those are the kinds of things that students often ask pointedly, oh, why didn't I learn this in high school? And so that then evolves into another conversation about, let's talk about the process of why certain books are purchased and used in high school and what you cannot and cannot teach in high school. And then they begin to understand a little bit better.
I mean, Dana, the reason why this matters, and I think one of the reasons why your piece has gotten so much response is, I mean, ultimately, we're talking about how we're shaping the next generation of Americans, right? And
yes.
And what they view, or how they view themselves as citizens of this country in, you know, the timeline of American history. It is a question of values, isn't it?
Correct. And that's why I wanted to launch this project here in early 2020 as we head into a presidential election. I think, you know, these questions about the legacy of slavery in American life, how unfettered should capitalism be? I mean, these are some of the biggest questions that we have in our political culture right now. And it's important to think about students' first exposure to these ideas.
Well, let's go to a caller here. Let's go to Megan, who's calling from Trumansburg, New York. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I've been a teacher of social studies. I'm also a certified reading teacher. And I just wanted to say a few things, that teaching is, you know, in its very act, a political thing, both in terms of what the state curriculum is or are and how the teacher fulfills those requirements while also fulfilling the charge to teach students to be critical consumers of media and history.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of bias is universal, as far as I know, teaching that in the United States. And I think about and have used the parable in class of the blind men feeling an elephant.
Right.
And one blind man feels the ear and says, an elephant is flat and wide. Another one feels a tail and says, no, an elephant is like a snake in the leg. It's like a trunk of a tree. So we're not feeling the whole elephant. You know, if we only look at certain sources. So, but if they talk to each other, they would get a round, huge understanding of what elephant is. And what we were doing when I was teaching middle school and high school is I would bring old textbooks from the same publisher and the newer updated version, and we would scan through them and find how, quote, history has changed. Did the facts actually change, or are we looking at them differently? And I think that that is could be a very valuable tool using a Texas and a California history textbook together on the same table with the same kids looking at the same ideas and talking about why these things are reported differently and who's reporting them.
Wow, that sounds like actually a wonderful exercise. Are you thinking about Are you actually thinking about doing that?
We've created curriculum.
What's that?
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say we've created a curriculum based on this reporting at the New York Times. So any teachers who are interested in doing that with their students can check that out on our website.
That's fabulous. Great.
Okay. Well, Megan, thank you for that call so much. That's Megan from Trumansburg, New York. Dana Goldstein, national correspondent for the New York Times, and Albert Broussard, a professor of history at Texas A&M University. Stand by for just a moment because we do have to take a quick break here. When we come back from that break, we will talk to a teacher in Texas who's using one of these textbooks and how she uses it in her classroom. We're talking about the different versions of American history that are presented to American high school students in ostensibly the same history textbooks and the impact that has on their understanding of U.S. history, on what citizenship means, and also the impact it has in today's extremely hyper-partisan times. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about two different versions of the same history textbook that appear in two different states, in California and Texas, and why those history books are so different from one another and the impact it has on young people and their understanding of U.S. history and their role in it. And we're talking today with Dana Goldstein. She's national correspondent for the New York Times, and it's her reporting on this exact subject. Terrific piece that inspired this hour's conversation. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Albert Broussard joins us as well from College Station, Texas. He's a professor of history at Texas A&M University and co-author of numerous high school history textbooks. And joining us now from Sunnyvale, Texas, is Kerry Green. Kerry is an 11th grade U.S. history teacher and social studies department chair at Sunnyvale High School. And Sunnyvale is a suburb of Dallas, Texas. Kerry Green, welcome to On Point.
Hello. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Obviously, you know, we want to get the view from inside the classroom. So just describe to us, how is it that you use the history textbook in your 11th grade class?
Well, the short answer is I don't. I mean,
I pretty much curate my own information. Now, I think one of the things that it's important to understand is that, you know, the state of Texas provides the TEKS, the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills. And that is the curriculum. That is what I am required to teach. And in the state of Texas, there is an 11th grade end of course test that students have to pass. They have to pass five tests. There's two English, a science, a math, and a history. And so my U.S. history class is one of those they have to pass. So my primary focus and is to follow those standards, right? Now, I have, and I'm fortunate to work at a school district that is progressive in the sense that it encourages the teachers to have some freedom in how they teach and the instructional resources. So I have some freedom to make choices about how I implement those TEKS, as long as I can validate that what I'm teaching is in the TEKS. So this gives me some flexibility. Now, that being said, the textbook is designed to fit those TEKS, right? So when you're talking about free enterprise or when you're talking about Reconstruction or the Harlem Renaissance or any of these issues that you've mentioned or that Dana has mentioned, what you're talking about is, you know, as long as I make sure that I've mentioned that TEK, I can then come in because of the freedom that I have and say, and there's another perspective on this. You know, there's another point of view. I talk to my students. Part of what I talk to them about is bias. And depending on the level of the class, sometimes I use the word historiography. Sometimes I just talk about the things that historians do. But I always make sure that they understand that there's choices that people make when they tell a story, mm-hmm. what they leave out, what they put in, and I encourage them to think for themselves and to try to explore other information. So the textbook is a resource.
It's a resource. Okay. You sound like a very experienced teacher. How long have you been in the classroom?
I've only been in the public school classroom for about 10 years. I was a non-traditional student, went back to college. Uh-huh. So I'm older, but, so I guess you could say I'm experienced in life. But teaching wise, you're talking about 10 years in the public high school and with a couple of extra years doing some college level teaching.
I guess I was asking because, you know, hopefully we are past the point in most schools where a teacher just puts a textbook in front of an 11th grader and says, read this chapter. That's your lesson on the Harlem Renaissance. But do these, you know, for you or your colleagues in Sunnyvale, does the textbook provide, I don't know, like you said, it's a tool, but it's like, is it a foundational tool? Does it help provide guidance in terms of what area of history to approach next and how, as you build on top of that?
I would say not necessarily. Okay. Like I know when I was first coming into the high school classroom. So, I mean, there was the period when I kind of taught at the college level. And then when I came into the high school classroom and I needed to make sure that I was teaching the TEKS, I did look at the textbook a little bit more. But I always supplemented it and I never viewed it as the final word. And now, I mean, that, you know, after the first year, that's not been the case at all. Right. And I've really kind of created my own thing because I'm very acquainted with the TEKS. And my experience with most teachers, especially teachers at my particular school district, which, like I said, is arguably a more progressive district, is that that's what they encourage their teachers to do, which is know your standards and then build lessons for the students that fit those standards. Mm. Now, you know, that can still be complicated, right? You still want to be sure, you know, my school district is a very conservative school district. So when I bring up issues like the lost cause myth or changing interpretations about the women's movement or, you know, all this kind of thing, my favorite part was last year I had assigned a video about Phyllis Schlafly. And one of my students emailed me and said, "What did you just make me watch?" And I thought, oh my goodness, I've gotten into trouble. And it turned out that she was just shocked that Phyllis Schlafly had opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. But it was it humored me afterwards because I had this moment of panic, which is, oh my goodness, I've totally upset this student. Their parents are going to be mad. you know, so there can be a dance there. Yeah. But I think ultimately, if you teach, part of the goal is to teach them to think critically and to be aware of biases and to examine bias and recognize when it's it's not a big deal, mm-hmm. or it's valid, or, you know, or when it's completely out of place. And that's just part of the process of educating, you know, future Americans and future voters.
Well, Dana, can I turn back to you for a second? Because it sounds like what Carrie's saying is relax, right? Like Californians who might be critical of the Texas versions of the books, or vice versa, Texans who might be critical of the Californian versions, like just relax. It's one tool that in a great high school classroom, one tool among many.
Yeah, and I think that's true. The only sort of counterpoint I'd add is that as part of my reporting for this project, I talked to a lot of folks who are sort of coaches for social studies teachers across the country and go into hundreds of classrooms over the course of years and decades. And what many of them said is that while great teachers like Carrie, who are experienced and extremely thoughtful and have put tons of time into curriculum development, may rely very little on their textbooks, it is certainly the case that beginner teachers, maybe those who don't have as much time or expertise in historiography, rely on them much more. Mm. And in fact, when I was conceiving of this project, one of the things that inspired me to do this is I went into a classroom of a really fantastic but quite young social studies teacher, and I looked over at her desk, and she had her McGraw-Hill book, which Al is one of the co-authors of, on her desk. And she had marked it all up. So there were sticky notes all over it, highlights, underlines, dog-eared pages. And I could see how important the book still was. She was not having her kids read aloud from the book, or she was doing very engaging lessons with them, but the book was greatly guiding her. And I would also add that there is a new emphasis, as I mentioned, on primary source reading in mm-hmm. history education. Now, where do teachers get their ideas from of what primary sources to go out and grab? There are some wonderful resources and organizations out there that can help teachers who are in the know. But for many teachers, they may look at the bolded names in their textbooks and go look for, you know, writings from those historical figures. So leaving stuff out, you know, what Al called crimes of omission, that's quite accurate. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to direct the teacher toward how to flesh out the lesson.
Well, let's get go ahead, Carrie. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I completely concur with that. One of the things, you know, and that's why I emphasize that this is my unique situation. And one of the things that concerns me in the sense of, and I think my thought process is they have got to, I mean, when you talk about how much time teachers have to plan, how much, you know, is there internet access? Do students have access to devices? Does a school in rural West Texas have the same, you know, internet access that I have? And so there's just a ton of nuances. And so it's part of the struggle of when you have this kind of large public education, institution, how do you meet the needs of so many diverse people, so many diverse communities, and then try to distill all that down into one resource? Because my situation is not the situation of every other teacher.
Yeah, well, you can't, right? The answer is you can't. You can't do all that work and distill it down into one resource.
Meghna, may I make a quick
comment
go ahead.
As well?
Yeah, I think Carrie's comment is an excellent one. It really speaks to both the freedom that I was speaking of earlier, the teachers in some progressive school districts have to supplement their textbooks, that the textbook is to be sure a very important source, but it's just one of many sources. And it's going to really vary widely, not just from school district to school district, but really the willingness of teachers to be able to take risks, so to speak. But I also would say that Texas history textbooks have really made a great deal of progress in talking about controversial subjects, or even the way that they portray subjects. For example, the coming of the Civil War. They may not say, like most college textbooks, that this was the cause of the Civil War, but at least they're discussing it in a way that they didn't 20 years ago. And one other resource, I don't know if Carrie's aware, but the State Humanities Organization, Humanities Texas, conducts teacher workshops throughout the state of Texas. And I say that because I was on the board of directors for three terms for 9 years, and we train thousands and thousands of teachers every year, and we gave about 12 to 15 awards to teachers to recognizing outstanding contributions in both high school and Texas history teaching as well.
Mm. Well, let me just make a little room for some of our callers here. Wieka is calling from Rapid City, South Dakota. You're on the air.
Hey,
Hey, I was just calling to make the comment. You know, we have these history books where, you know, it's black and white history. And, you know, I just want to say it's just nice to be included because with Native Americans were, you know, hardly ever mentioned after 1492. Just our achievements and our contributions to American society are just never, ever featured in those books.
So the crime of omission, as we've been talking about earlier, Wiyoka, right, in terms of Native history.
Exactly. You know, just and when I was in school for South Dakota history, we're in this class for 9 months. The one day that we had that was devoted to Native American history, we watched a movie that was called A Man Called Horse. And if you think a reference to Dances with Wolves is outdated, that A Man Called Horse was outdated at that time as outdated. And so, you know, it's just we don't ever get included in these histories and the stories of America.
Well, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Alejandro, who's calling from West Stockbridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling because I just thought it was really interesting how one of the teachers, I don't know her name, but she was talking about how she chooses not to use the state-provided textbooks in order to she herself curate her own textbooks. So I'm just my main concern is how are teachers influencing their classrooms with their own biases, be it progressive or any other view? How do we have any checks and balances to ensure that students are encouraged to make their own research and to make up their own minds? Even though, of course, history, of course, we would like it to be taught in the most factual and accurate way in order to, you know, raise a generation's critical thinking. So my concern is what happens when teachers in general influence their classroom with their own political biases.
Well, Alejandro, thank you for that question. Carrie Green, would you like to respond to him?
Yeah, sure. I think first off, you know, if the teacher is following the state standards, and the accountability for that is the administration on the campus, right? If they're turning in lesson plans as per their contract, if they can pull up their resources and show what they've been doing and show where it aligns to the standards, then I think that lessens the risk of political bias. And so I think that's first and foremost the most important thing. Any responsible ethical teacher is going to use that as their touchstone, and that will restrain you. I think the other thing too is that the goal is not the perception that teachers are trying to shape a political viewpoint, I think I think that's more myth than fact. I don't know of a teacher that doesn't care about the students that they have, that they want them to think, they want them to engage. And, you know, that looks different in different classrooms. You know, I've seen teachers that would tease and kind of challenge and say crazy, outrageous things to get students, either liberal or conservative, to argue back to them and to create kind of a fun, kind of silly dialogue. But I've also seen teachers that would have very, you know, serious conversations. Teachers fundamentally care about the students. They want the students to be educated. And, you know, whether they're following the textbook because, you know, for whatever reason, time constraints, inexperience, or whether they're like me and they have the freedom and the willingness to curate other things. And you know, either way, those teachers care about the kids. Mm-hmm. And if a good history, social studies, government teacher is relying on their state standards that they should follow and relying on primary source material as most people in the last, you know, 20 years of history education and probably before have been taught to do, then I think the likelihood of having a political bias comes in. And when all else fails, you own it. You say, This is what the history is, and how you interpret that history is up to you. I can tell you my interpretation, but that's my interpretation.
Right.
And so I think that the notion that there's this fixed set of facts that we can say, this is the fact. Well, we know July 4th, 1776 is when they, you know, when they finished, you know, when they finished signing the Declaration, although it actually started a couple days before, but You know, so even that can be questionable about what is the fact.
Right.
But part of the narrative that I think gets put out there with this myth is that these facts are fixed. Well, with history, when you're talking about people and stories, I would argue it's not as fixed.
Yeah. Well, Kerry Green, that's a perfect thought to leave us with. And quite frankly, it's one of the reasons why we believe that more voices and more stories thrown into the mix is really one of the ways forward here. So Kerry Green, 11th grade U.S. history teacher in Sunnyvale, Texas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Albert Broussard, professor of history at Texas A&M University, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Dana Goldstein, national correspondent for the New York Times and reporter behind the piece about two different textbooks. Dana, thank you so much for reading all those pages and for your reporting. Thank you again.
Thank you, Magna.
And we have links to Dana's reporting at onpointradio.org. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.